This evening, program is dedicated to the proposition of honoring one of the great men of Sunstone, R. Dean Watts, who's been with us at every symposium, I understand, except one since it started, which gets us into probably about 25 of them. And we're all, those of us who've been here very long, are well accustomed to being cajoled and badgered and sucked into singing as loud as we could and as long as we could at every kind of music imaginable. It's wonderful to have R. Dean here. He's one of those great pioneers of Sunstone that have been with it a long time. There's some names that are people who've gone by: Sam Taylor, Gene England, who have gone. But we have Ed Kimball here, and Mary Bradford's not here this year. There's one more. I wrote someone down here. Michael Quinn, the Toscanos, and I could go on. But R. Dean is in that select group of people who've been here and made Sunstone really good what it is. I run into R. Dean pretty regularly the past couple of years, early in the morning at up at the Steiner Fitness Center near the University of Utah. And occasionally see, when I come up there, I see this gnome-like looking figure sitting on an exercise, pounding away with sort of perspiration coming off that beard down there, just going as hard as he can. And then he goes over and pumps the weights and gets up and comes along and shakes my hand and goes home just satisfied as can be. Please imply that he's there, and I'm happy to see him. It sort of gives me inspiration. We're joined tonight by R. Dean's, some of R. Dean's family and friends, and let me introduce them. First of all, I have his wife, Elna. Would you stand up, Elna? And he has a brother, Don. Don, would you stand up? Thanks, Don. And his children, five of his children are here. Mark, would you stand up, Mark? Am I missing him? Is he coming back? Well, let's go on to Mitzi. Where's Mitzi? Okay, Mitzi. Stay up. Meryl. There's Milton. Where is Milton? Okay. All right. I'm finding. And Melanie's last. Thanks, Milton. And still no Mark. Okay. Okay. Would the spouses of the children just mentioned stand up, please? Yeah, not really. And then we have the wonderful progeny of the grandchildren. Would you stand up? All of you over there. And a special guest of R. Dean, the widow of, I guess, Utah's greatest musical icon, Marisa Bravanel. Is Carolyn Bravanel here? I guess Maurice and R. Dean were stick buddies for a long time, as we used to say in the Air Force. Yeah, good, okay. Well, we'll now proceed with the program, and R. Dean wanted me to issue this, I guess, disclaimer that there are a lot of personal uses of the personal pronoun I in this program, and he says it was not his idea. Dan Witherspoon forced him to do it. So with that, we'll go on from there.
Cataclysmic events in the early 20th century turned out to be fortunate events for me. The first was the Great Depression. which began in my second year, and the second was the sinking of the Titanic, April 15th, 1912. My paternal grandfather, Harvey Franklin Watts, in addition to leading the Kanosh, Utah band, wrote the song of which I will sing a couple of lines. The great Titanic left Southampton to sail across the ocean blue, but little did she think of sinking with her passengers and crew. That performance is, with apologies to my brother Don, who is a real singer. That story is tangible evidence that my musical gifts were inherited and not earned. As for the Great Depression, it drove my father from the family farm in Kanosh, Utah, where I was born, to find work as a grocer in several towns in southern Idaho, arriving eventually in Idaho Falls, where I attended school from the fourth grade through high school and enjoyed the cultural advantage of big city life. My mother was raised in Smoot, Wyoming, population 76. She did not appear to be musically gifted. She claimed there was not a single piano in the town, and that somehow translated into an obsession that there would be music in our home. All three of the Watts children, Ardeen, Don, and Blaine, became professional musicians. She began her own study of piano at 76, and mine at 5. My mother and father provided us with music lessons at an early age and eventually made hundreds of pilgrimages to Salt Lake City from Idaho after their nest was empty to hear their sons perform. My father sang vocal solos in church throughout his life and bass in an Idaho Falls male quartet. I displayed obvious musical gifts at an early age, including pitch memory and a natural dexterity at the piano. However, they were not accompanied with either discipline or diligence. My first piano teacher gave up on me when I was 6, but mother was not easily deterred. I gave my first full evening solo recital in Blackfoot, Idaho, Second Ward Chapel at age 8. It took me 5 more years to get ready for my second recital. During junior and senior high school, I performed several nights a week, either as a pianist or singing with my friends. I probably owe more of my love for music to my neighbor in Idaho Falls, Ralph Ritting, than either my parents or my music teachers. He was hemophilic, unable to attend public school, but extremely well-read and a fanatical lover of classical music. I became ward organist at around age 12 and expressed a certain perverse delight in improvising popular songs into the prelude music for Sunday school. One of those must have planted a seed which was to bear fruit about 35 years later. Don't fence me in. I graduated from Idaho Falls High School at age 17 in the spring of 1945. And just missed being drafted in World War II. I started playing jazz as a sophomore in high school combos. In the summer of 1944, After my junior year of high school, three of us spent the summer at Max Inn, south of Yellowstone Park, playing in a tavern with an illegal poker game in the back room. We played there two summers, terminating with the surrender of Japan, September 2nd, 1945. I admit to being disappointed when I was called to the New England mission in 1947. I had something more exotic than mine, like Western Europe. But the New England mission under President S. Dilworth Young offered more adventure than I could possibly have hoped for. Another fortuitous chapter of my life. While visiting the mission home on my first day in Boston, I introduced myself by sitting down to the grand piano in the mission home living room, uninvited. A few bars into the first piece, President Young strode into the room and thundered, "Elder Watts, will you please stop playing the piano?" President Young had a vision of restoring the New Testament style of doing missionary work by sending us out without purse or scrip, trusting in the Lord that people would offer us bed and breakfast every day. As soon as the snow melted, we were to put our trunks in storage, hit the road with a suitcase, not heavier than 12 pounds, including tracts and six books of Mormon. Contents included disposable paper collars for white shirts, a change of essential clothes, toilet articles, and an umbrella. To this day, I consider my mission one of the greatest adventures of my life. And for icing on the cake, I had Armand Moss as a companion. In 1945, BYU had a total enrollment of under 3,000, mostly female. That year was more memorable for my relationship with a young woman, Norma Boots Obig, now Sullivan, than for any academic achievement on my part. I considered my enrollment at BYU at such a time to have been a fortunate event indeed. Following my mission, I returned to BYU in 1950. Where I had opportunities to conduct the Delta Phi Missionary Corps, to perform as piano soloist with BYU's premier performing groups, and to play in two swing bands. Like my first stint at BYU, my second was also dominated by the female race. I met the love of my life, Elna Brown, whom you have already met, while singing in Crawford Gates' chorus. We both added astronomy to the curriculum, which required many nights observing the stars with appropriate attention to other heavenly bodies. We married in 1951 while she was still a teenager. By 1952's graduation, she was about to deliver our first son, Mark, the missing one. I was a husband and a father and unemployed with a BS in music theory. My best job option was teaching for the Fossen Music Store in Pocatello, Idaho. I taught group piano on fake wooden keyboards, which I made myself with a jigsaw. And I paid $5 for a certificate that indicated that I was a certified accordion teacher. By spring, I knew there had to be something better than that. A piano teacher colleague in Pocatello suggested I go to Europe to study further, as she had done. Elna agreed to support us as a file clerk at Phillips Petroleum in Salt Lake. As soon as the hay was in, her mother and father moved from Bear Lake, Idaho, to Salt Lake City to help care for our infant son. When spring called them back to the farm, the Watts grandparents took their turn, and I was off on another adventure on the good ship Rheindom, heading for Vienna, improvising without a theme. I was accepted as a student by one of the respected piano faculty of the world-famous Vienna Academy of Music. I was not surprised that he suggested we start over with the basics. It was soon obvious to me that I was beyond my depth. Every day hearing my colleagues play was torture for me. Although I continued to practice several hours a day, my agenda in Vienna gradually shifted toward total immersion in Vienna's artistic life. I attended at least one concert a day and all of the rehearsals that I could bribe myself into. Standing room at the Vienna Opera, that's the building on the far left, cost 12 cents. And I was young and healthy enough to lead the rush of students to the fifth balcony without permanent side effects. We borrowed money from my father so that Elna could join me the following spring. Together, we improvised a grand European tour. We hitchhiked about half the time and were occasionally entertained in private homes by people we met on the road. After 3 idyllic months traveling, we returned to Utah, where we have lived continually since 1954. I put my missionary tracting skills to work in the bountiful neighborhood where we lived, and soon had about 20 piano students. The Salt Lake City School District hired me as an instrumental music teacher for 5 inner city elementary schools. I held on until Christmas of 1956, when I retired permanently from public school teaching. Meanwhile, I had joined the George Engar Band, featured at Salt Air Resort in summer and Rainbow Rendezvous and Terrace Ballroom in the downtown Salt Lake in the winter. The following year, George retired, and I bought the band, changed the name, and we continued to play in the same venues. We backed up international celebrities such as Nat King Cole, Sarah Vaughan, June Christie, the Four Freshmen, Dave Brubeck, etc. In 1957, I became the pianist with the Utah Symphony and sold the band with the intention of going straight. I had occasional lapses when a good-paying club job or a traveling show came to town. I even played Hammond organ for one performance of Ringling Brothers Circus, which was a miracle because I had never played a Hammond organ. My main assets were that I could sight read like crazy and I was always sober. I didn't dare tell Maurice Abravanel, my classical mentor, that when I had to learn something really difficult, in a hurry, I would write jazz chords into the score and just fake it. In fact, I have often claimed that while some people, like my famous friend the explorer John Goddard, strongly advise goal setting, I get through life by improvising. I'm still faking it. The event that was to change the course of my life was meeting Maurice Abravanel in 1956. I was enrolled as a graduate student at the University of Utah, and at a special event, accompanied the national anthem conducted by the famous maestro, who came to Salt Lake in 1947. an auspicious year. Afterward, I drove him home and asked if I could audition for him. His reply, "Don't bother. I've more good pianists than I know what to do with. Reed Nibley, Robert Kundig, Lowell Farr, and so on." A few months later, a singer auditioned for him and requested that I accompany her. At the audition, Abravanel leaned over to Lowell Durham, the Dean of Fine Arts, and whispered, "Who's that playing the piano?" That moment changed the course of the rest of my life. A few months later, the maestro called me and asked me if I knew the opera Salome by Richard Strauss. Naturally, I said yes. Actually, I had seen the opera once in Vienna. Robert Kundig was not available to play for the rehearsals, which were to start the morning after in his basement, in Abravanel basement studio. I stayed up all night writing jazz chord symbols into the piano score. A few months later, the Utah Symphony Office called and asked if I knew the Symphony No. 5 by Shostakovich, which has a very demanding piano part. Reed Nibley, the symphony's official pianist and my former teacher, was ill and couldn't play the combination rehearsal and school concert at Granite High School. Naturally, I said, "Yes. Well, I had heard it." Shortly afterward, Reed moved to Provo to teach at BYU, and I was offered a permanent position in the orchestra. Carl Fürstner, an incredibly gifted pianist and operatic coach, was hired to direct an opera workshop at the University of Utah. He asked if I would be his assistant. It turned out that he had more irons in the fire than he could manage, and before the year was over, Dean Durham had asked me if I would like to take over the opera workshop. The university had recently made piano lessons for all music majors mandatory, and I suddenly wound up as an adjunct faculty member with 50 students and a view office in what is now David Gardner Hall, while still working on my master's degree. My cash flows were over, but time flow was out of control. A career in opera had never crossed my mind. After a successful experience with the summer festival opera Salome, Abravanel asked if I would like to conduct the university theater production of Damn Yankees in Kingsbury Hall. Again, I was in the right place at the right time. Rehearsals for The Barber of Seville began later in the fall, and I was engaged as the coach pianist. I soon found out that while piano practice was lonely and boring, that coaching and teaching and conducting was fun, and I could keep going around the clock without tiring. So there you have it, my profession found me. In 10 years with the opera workshop, I produced about 40 student performances. In 1965, I founded the University of Utah Opera Company, and under its auspices produced and conducted 20 additional operas in Kingsbury Hall with the Utah Symphony. With my appointment as associate conductor of the Utah Symphony, I had to give up opera production. Altogether, I conducted or coached about 30 complete operas at the University of Utah. A highlight of those opera years was a production of Wagner's The Flying Dutchman, to this day the only Wagner opera to be produced in Utah. It wasn't that good. Our first birding experience began one morning as we were driving to Bear Lake to visit my wife's parents. Our station wagon was trained to avoid pavement in favor of dusty roads less traveled. We suddenly found ourselves entering the Bear River Refuge near Brigham City, observing avocets, stilts, cormorants, ibis, and egrets for the first time. Our final destination, Liberty, Idaho, birthplace of my wife, was only a few minutes from the Bear Lake Bird Refuge, which proved to be just as exciting. From then on, carrying binoculars and a bird book was as necessary for even a short hop in the car as gasoline. All of our 8 children and their families are birders, and some of them are better than I participated for several years in the Great Salt Lake Bird Count, which meant weekly trips to inventory birds at assigned locations on the Great Salt Lake. Perhaps my peak birding experience was spending 10 days on top of a mountain in the Goshute Range on the Nevada border, catching, counting, and banding raptors as they migrated south in the fall, untangling a wild red-tailed hawk from a mist net after it has swooped down to take a live pigeon tethered to a pole is indeed high adventure. My father supported us from the small grocery store he owned in Idaho Falls, Idaho. But his real passions were hunting and fishing. He made weekly trips into the hills with a fly rod or rifle. Venison, elk, wild birds were regular fare at our table, often garnished with wild asparagus, watercress, huckleberries, etc. Coming of age, for us, meant owning a rifle and a fishing pole, which made scouting irrelevant. As an adult, I took up archery, thinking it a more sporting way to take game. After my first kills, a jackrabbit, a carp, and a sage hen, I had second thoughts. Killing animals eventually hurt my conscience enough that I became a vegetarian for 15 years. However, my interest in wild food continued when Ewell Gibbon's book, Stalking the Wild Asparagus, hit the bookstores. I was hooked. Before long, we were inviting friends over for weed dinners. When Gibbons came to Salt Lake City promoting grape nuts, we got together for an afternoon of foraging. He had a chapter on wild mushrooms in his book, but I discovered early on I needed to know more. Within a few years, I had a library of 200 books on wild mushrooms. When I retired from teaching at the University of Utah in 1993, I organized the Mushroom Society of Utah and am currently its president. My mushroom students and colleagues have taught hundreds of interested people how to forage safely for wild mushrooms, of which there are about 2,000 varieties in the Wasatch Mountains, and here are a few of the smaller ones. My Utah Symphony career began in 1957. And lasted for 22 years until Abravanel's resignation in May 1979, and mine shortly afterward. The most auspicious event of my early years was my appearance as piano soloist in Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue with guest conductor Paul Whiteman. He actually commissioned the piece in 1924 for his own orchestra, and conducted the premiere with Gershwin himself as the soloist. The morning after our performance in the LDS Tabernacle, I opened the Salt Lake Tribune and read, "Ardeen Watts deserved the praise extended by Mr. Whiteman. The conductor was of the opinion that Watts plays the work as well as anyone, including George Gershwin." soon. I told Dan it was wrong to include that. Soon afterward, the symphony began a series of summer pops concerts at Lagoon. Since Abravanel spent the summers in California, I was asked to conduct the series. School concerts were also added to my plate, along with a string of University of Utah theater musicals, including Damn Yankees, Redhead, The Unsinkable Molly Brown, Guys and Dolls, Peter Pan, Fantastics, Half a Sixpence, and so on. Another great adventure was the Utah Symphony's first international tour to Europe in 1964. Of course, Abravanel did all the conducting on tour, but I played orchestral piano in such venues as the Athens Festival at the foot of the Acropolis, the Vienna Musikverein, home of the Vienna Philharmonic, Berlin, Paris, London, and so on. Life didn't change after my appointment as associate conductor in 1968. My contract read that I had to be prepared to take over any rehearsal or performance of the orchestra without notice. So I had to have my full dress ready to put on in 5 minutes. I often conducted concerts without ever having had a rehearsal with the orchestra. For me, that was life on the edge. I do admit that some performances may have had a few rough edges, but I never had a breakdown. I had been a fan of contemporary classical music since I was a teenager. The University of Utah co-sponsored 2 Utah Symphony concerts a year of contemporary music on the U of U campus. It was my good fortune to be assigned to conduct many of those. That gave me the opportunity to conduct challenging new works with the luxury of rehearsals. Many of them were Utah premieres, including major works by Shostakovich, Penderecki, Britten, Copland, Stravinsky, and others. You caught me at a bad moment there. I couldn't have imagined such a thing as a young musician. The peak of my conducting career was a production of Leonard Bernstein's Mass, written for the opening of the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. A fantastic stage was built in the U of U Special Events Center. In addition to an augmented Utah symphony, there were 2 rock bands, the combined choruses of the University of Utah, or the University Music Department, a cast of 20 soloists, dancers from Ballet West, a guest celebrant from New York City. It remains to this day a highlight of my life. The Utah Symphony sponsored me to represent them in the Salt Lake Rotary Club, beginning in 1970. 36 years later, I am still a member. It has been an outlet for both my gregarious nature and my humanitarian impulses. On the other hand, an essential part of me craves solitude. One place I found it is in the Great Basin Desert, 40 miles from the nearest paved road, the Gandhi Marsh. Volunteers from Nature Conservancy monitor it yearly. For several years running, I parked my minivan where no vehicle tracks were visible and spent a few days healing from the wounds of urban pressure. My pilgrimages there helped me keep a balance between the delights of civilization and the delights of solitude. I've heard it said by more than one red-blooded American Mormon man that the best job in the church is teaching primary. It isn't. It's serving on the general board of the Young Men's Mutual Improvement Association in the 1960s and 70s. For many of us, it was a marriage made in heaven, inventing and producing artistic events to enlarge the minds and hearts of young church members. Beginning in 1966, general board members were assigned to accompany general authorities to district and state conferences. It was a heady experience. I felt the rush of being on that powerful team. In 1974, President Kimball called the combined boards to an early morning meeting in the basement of the tabernacle and released the 120 extraordinary people who had been serving in that capacity. I still feel the church was diminished for having ended those programs. But life is changed, and we must move on. The names of some of the events we produce over a period of 15 years still reverberate in the memories of thousands. Praise Ye the Lord, Papa and the Playhouse, All in Favor, Sing a New Song, We'll Sing and We'll Shout, Make a Joyful Noise. About 1 o'clock p.m. on March 10th, 1974, I was comfortably slouched in my usual seat on the Utah Symphony's Saints bus, heading for Denver. I had every reason to be happy with the way my life was going. My careers with the Utah Symphony and the University of Utah seemed to be in the ascendancy. I was 46, still healthy, had a loving wife, and 8 children. My church job could not have been more satisfying. As we crossed the border into Colorado, I suddenly felt myself on the cusp of a moment for which there had been no anticipation, nor any hint of what it might portend. Ideas from a book I was reading seemed to be emptying me as surely as if someone had pulled the proverbial plug. I thought I might be experiencing the swelling motions for which I had prayed so many times. My eyes became moist with tears, and I felt grace descend upon me. I vowed that if the Spirit spoke to me in unmistakable terms, I would follow its promptings regardless of the consequences. An absurd idea immediately popped into my head. I was to buy a pair of roller skates while I was in Denver. This was followed by another that I read a book entitled OASPI. I wondered what I had gotten myself into. As a missionary in the backwoods of Massachusetts 26 years before that, a grizzled old man who was examining the Book of Mormon I had just given him walked out of the room and returned with a huge volume saying, "If you will read my Bible, I will read yours." My companion was already asleep in the rocking chair. I thumbed through the pages of a book called OASPI. My eyes randomly focused on the word Mormon in the index. I quickly turned to page 769, verse 7. Quote, "A Drugen god, Piat, established a sect and named it Mormon, and he located his kingdom on earth with his mortal followers, and he became master over the spirits of his mortal followers," and so on. I felt a shock go through me, and I quickly handed his Bible back to him, explaining I would not be able to read his book. He returned the Book of Mormon to me. My companion and I went out into the night. I followed that prompting next morning in the Denver Public Library. While OASPI played a powerful part as I began the journey I was embarked on, it has not been a significant force in the 32 years since that event. As for roller skating, it became a trademark that was to characterize my newfelt freedom for years to come. That afternoon, I witnessed my Mormon self dissolve, and I began the long process of building a faith my conscience could live with. My course correction brought other demands, which released a latent activist within me. Initially, I was inspired by the career of Mahatma Gandhi. Causes included becoming a vegetarian, protesting against the nuclear arms race and the building of missile silos in Utah's West Desert, producing New Year's Eve interfaith peace celebrations at Kingsbury Hall, and Hiroshima-Nagasaki memorial services, leading hymn singing at vigils protesting the excommunication of LDS intellectuals, and a three-day piano play-in in front of the federal building when the U.S. House of Representatives voted against funding for the National Endowment for the Arts. It was the most fun I ever had. The last was a fitting sequel to 8 years service as a member and eventually chairman of the board of the Utah Arts Council. I confess that the notion of eternal family is incomprehensible to me. I guess I'm simply a here and now person. I face death with the same ignorance as I did the begetting and raising of our children. I consider myself extremely lucky in convincing Elna Brown to marry me, but she took unfair advantage of her natural charm, resulting in a family of eight. She did more than her share in the raising of them. For one who is an avowed tree hugger, I confess I have no defense for their number, except a profound ignorance of the consequences of loving her, a slight variation on Joseph Smith's "Men Are That They Might Have Joy." If I were to describe our children individually, five of whom you have met, we'd be here until dawn. They are my best friends and my teachers. When Grace altered the course of my life in 1974, our youngest was a year old, and my first son to go on a mission was preparing to leave for Brazil. All four of our sons and two of our daughters chose to go on missions. Where did I go wrong? But only one overtly tried to bring me back into the faith. What Joseph Campbell said of the world is true applied to families. They are messy. They are perfect. They have always been messy. I love the mess. And with almost 40 grandchildren, the messes are deep and wide. They all married partners whom they met in LDS singles wards. All have chosen to live under the gospel net. I have been the designated babysitter at all of their weddings. If I should be lucky enough to spend the rest of my days on a deserted island, I would want them for my companions. It does not take a great imagination to conclude that our family raising years were hectic. I had three concurrent paying jobs, the University of Utah, the Utah Symphony, and other Pioneer, and either Pioneer Theater or Ballet West. However, I managed to protect Sundays and the majority of summers. In keeping with my natural inclinations, that meant yearly mega vacations. Typically, we travel in a van large enough to seat us all with a room for a few friends while pulling a small travel trailer behind. We fished in waters off Ensenada, snorkeled in the Sea of Cortez, grazed up the Pacific coast from the California redwoods to the Olympic Peninsula, sat in awe of the portraits in stone at Mount Rushmore, rode horses in the backcountry of the Navajo National Monument, rolled Easter eggs at arches, hiked in the Grand Canyon, chased bison in Yellowstone. Adventure on the world stage was largely courtesy of my musical career. In addition to the USO-sponsored tour to the Orient with Damn Yankees, and the three-month tour to Europe with my wife after my year of study in Vienna, I performed with the Utah Symphony on three tours of Europe and a six-weeks tour in South America. I conducted for Ballet West at the Herodotus Atticus Amphitheater in Athens, as well as in Spain. I was tour guide for a tour of Europe's great opera houses and served as accompanist for Ballet West dancers in international competitions in Russia and Japan. Even so, my appetite was not filled. I spent a month in Kenya on safari with John Goddard and made several additional trips to Japan just for the fun of it. Our travels are documented in thousands of 35mm slides and photos and countless irreplaceable memories. In January 2003, my wife, Elna, was struck by an automobile while crossing the street on the way to a movie. My dear friend, Jack Whitaker, Wright, was killed in that accident. Elna sustained severe bleeding in her right frontal lobe. An operation that night saved her life. On the 12th day, she began to regain consciousness. 3 weeks later, she was taken off life support and began several months of therapy. If I believe that God grants special favors to those who beg, I still wouldn't have dared ask for the outcome we are enjoying today. She doesn't drive, cook, or do math. But she never did. A slight adjustment in domestic duties took care of that adequately. Her joy is unbounded when she rises in the morning from our bed alive. She laughs at misfortune most of the time. The last thing I hear at night are her giggles. She is more observant, more positive, more patient, more tolerant, and more loving than ever before. This is the best year of the 55 we have lived together. With Elna's dramatic return to life, I informed our children that rather than leave an inheritance for the family to agonize over, we would have more and better parties. In October 2004, a year and a half ago, we met our eight children and their spouses at LAX for an extended week in Kyoto, Japan. We stayed at a fine Japanese hotel and visited all of the must-see tourist sites by taxi. Each night we ate gourmet meals in different and memorable venues, traveled 2 days by charter bus to glorious locations not on anyone's tourist itinerary, and we didn't wait once for Elna to catch up. Families that travel together get well acquainted. Money and I have had an ambivalent relationship. As a child of the Depression, I should have grown up with a healthy respect for it. I never cared about it enough to be willing to keep accurate records. But my casual approach to accounting persists over the objections of Elna, who is very orderly, but who keeps forgetting the meaning of decimal points. I figure it's better to give away 20% than to keep accurate records on 10. All our bills are on auto pay, and I don't get exercised about who might be cheating me as long as I can see a balance at income tax time that I can live with. Luck has been better for me than being smart or good, which is very fortunate because I am neither. The causes I give to start and end with the environment and include peace, human rights, education, liberal politics, the arts, and, believe it or not, population control. My children pay no attention to me. Dan Weatherspoon's invitation to participate in this event ended my delusion that I would somehow escape the onerous task of placing my files in order. During my professional years, I accumulated many file drawers with correspondence, programs, photographs, journals, lectures, and the like. On the few occasions when curiosity or external pressure drove me to open them, the sheer bulk forced me to close them as soon as possible. During my preparation for this event, I found tapes of a number of performances I conducted of the Utah Symphony in the LDS Tabernacle, copies of which my children gave me upon my retirement from the symphony 27 years ago. I put one on the cassette machine for 10 minutes and decided I would wait another 27 years before trying it again. Retirement has been glorious and frustrating. Glorious in that I've been able to apply a very impractical criterion when choosing between activities. Is it fun? The downside is that I had expectations that in retirement I would have time to listen to all of the great music, or read all the great books and become a linguist, or at least a better informed naturalist. Alas, the agenda remains largely undone, with only a few nibbles at a block of cheese the size of the world. Travel has never been a necessity for my wife. Since her accident, being in comfortable, predictable surroundings has even more appeal. Last fall, I decided that virtual travel was a way of having both her cake and mine. I chose China as my destination. My China library now numbers over 50 books and growing. That formerly incomprehensible country is beginning to make just a tiny bit of sense to me now. I can pronounce the names of the provinces, so they are understandable to a native. I meet weekly with a friend who is a Chinese exchange teacher from Beijing, teaching Mandarin at East and West High Schools. I can lose my way in the Yellow Mountains and ride a camel on the Silk Road and enjoy the comforts of my own bed at night and raid my own refrigerator when the going gets really rough. As a student, I generally read only the books I was required to read, and those neither with relish nor care. Notable exceptions were occasional forays into LDS scripture as necessitated by class lessons I was asked to give, and Les Miserables, which I read to my children over a period of a year in place of early morning scriptures. With my course correction of 1974, I felt driven to delve into the things I had formerly avoided and passed by. I began buying books as if they would disappear from the earth. When we moved to University Street in 1988, we planned for a library of 2,500 books. It wasn't enough. Via books, I converse with such towering personages as Jesus, love your enemies of Nazareth, Joseph, men are that they might have joy, Smith, Gautama, dealing with the bad stuff, Buddha, Malcolm, who you are is beautiful, X, Henry, put up or shut up, Thoreau, Pope John the 23rd, course correction model for institutional religion. William, it's okay to be human, Shakespeare. Mark, laughter, the ultimate philosophy, Twain. Helen, make the best of the deck you're dealt, Keller. And hundreds more, including Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, Mozart, Mahler, Shostakovich, hearers of the inner spheres. For me, there are prophets many, scriptures many, and at least one God out there for everyone. In 1999, my physician retired, and I was faced with finding a new doctor. After an initial examination, she requested I come to her office. She poked her head into the waiting room and, spying me, spoke in a voice I hadn't heard since the days when my mother lectured me about practicing. Well, your cholesterol is out of sight, your blood pressure is out of control, and you have diabetes. You are a walking time bomb. Other patients were staring at me, and I hid behind a People magazine as best I could. This probably doesn't sound to you like a fortunate event, but as it turned out, when I arrived home, I contacted a personal trainer who met me in the gym where she worked and suggested I start modestly but work regularly. My usual mode, however, is to attack everything with the throttle wide open. I had visions of insulin needles, a painfully restrictive diet, and even dropping dead while shoveling the sidewalk. So I went to the gym 7 days a week, 2 hours a day. It's the most boring thing I have ever done in my life. The best that could be said for it was that dozens of young yuppie mothers went there to regain their former figures, and that compensated for quite a bit of the boredom and the pain. I am now in my 7th year. I've cut down to 3 days a week, but I can leg press 400 pounds, and I have yet to take my first insulin pill. Normally, my highest criterion for engaging in any activity is it fun? Going to the gym 6 hours a week is my most notable compromise with this principle. I first heard of Sunstone from founder Scott Kenny himself. He had been a violist in the symphony, and I was drawn to his intellect and offbeat Mormon style. Imagine my surprise and delight when a liberal elder in my ward, there were two, came into the high priest group meeting a few months later to distribute subscription forms for a new magazine called Sunstone. Naturally, my collection of Sunstone magazines starts with issue number one. Those first issues were hard-hitting, and I felt I had awakened in paradise. When the symposia started, I knew I had found my people. In those days, Sunstone was a necessity for me. I have only missed one symposium to date. Eventually, my relationship with it entered a phase I characterize as stimulating, but no longer necessary. I continue with Sunstone because it's the best game in town. Where can you enjoy mingling with minds of the first order within a free ambiance about things that really matter? And above all, it's fun. Most Sunstone devotees understand how one can be lonely in a congregation of 100 people, hundreds of people, many of them good friends. I was a majority of one in our nuclear family of 10. Pardon me, a minority of one in our nuclear family of 10 for the majority of our family life. They knew I was different, but I continued to go to church meetings regularly. Though I sang in the choir, I was exempt from choir practice. Professional courtesy. However, I found my mind was not nimble enough to do the dance between orthodoxy and the demands of conscience. The bishop thought it safe to ask me to lead the congregational singing in the 15 minutes devoted to it in an earlier incarnation of the block system. My first day on the job was just prior to Thanksgiving. I borrowed the symphony's 18-inch crash cymbals and arranged to meet with a young deacon whom I knew I could count on. He quickly got the hang of the bang. I told him whenever I pointed to him to give it all he had. I was delighted to see the stake president enter and take his place on the stand behind me. When it was our turn, I opened my 10-pound Bible and shouted as loudly as I could from the 150th Psalm, "Praise God with a high-sounding cymbal," and pointed to my accomplice. He stood on the front row and crashed the two metal plates against each other, lifting them high above his head for maximum reverberation. I cued the organist, and she started the fanfare to "God of Our Fathers" with all the stops open. Mothers went with screaming babies filled the aisles, heading for the foyer. The survivors lifted their voices in mighty praise, and we had ushered in a new era of congregational singing in Stratford Ward. For reasons I cannot fathom, I was allowed to continue in that position for several months. Each week, a game of chicken to see how far I could push the envelope. We had kettle drums and trumpets for the Hallelujah Chorus at Christmas and guitars for Amazing Grace in January, but I knew it was too good to last. Within a few weeks, the chapel was overflowing for the singing, and a mass exodus occurs when classes began. The singing time was abolished church-wide in the spring, and I was out of a job. I still harbor the fantasy that I might have contributed some small bit to that change. I have had a tacit agreement with the symposium directors that I do not select the songs to be sung at Sunstone events. I claim artistic license as if it were the Fifth Amendment, the same way an opera singer handles the role of a villain. The performer is not morally responsible for the content of the text. If God listens, he or she knows that in my heart of heart, I am a non-believer of many of the sentiments expressed in the Songs of Zion. On the other hand, I am an artist, and when I perform, I do it with my whole heart. As Maurice Abravanel, my Jewish agnostic mentor, did when he conducted the Book of Mormon oratorio. In the heat of rehearsal and performance, to him, Samuel the Lamanite was totally real. I heard him preach to the tabernacle choir so they would sing it with as much conviction as he. I try to live my life in the same way. I have participated in the blessing of grandchildren as a true believer, And in my heart of hearts, I know there is virtue in the ceremony, and I rejoice. But I am also a Jew, a Muslim, an atheist, and a Democrat. Even I have trouble with Republican these days. After all, what is absolutely pure and transparent in this world? Perhaps the best we can do is to step easily over the barriers which divide us from one another. Thank you.
All the Watts kids are coming up to help our dean do this last round of singing. Please grab your program. On the last page, you'll find All Creatures of Our God and King. And these are the creatures that we're putting before you today. We're going to sing one verse to kind of warm you up. Now, you should know that every single ward choir that has a member of the Watts family conducting it has cymbals used, and we have cymbals tonight, so prepare yourselves. And we all are cheap imitations of our father, but we do have the same gusto. So the warm-up verse, lest you try hard to understand what we're saying, is a knockoff of the PG-13 or R version that I wrote that has been censored and calmed down by my sister. The words will be, Mitzi, all creatures of our God and King, now gather round and let us sing. With our Dean, we will sing. Though he expects we'll know our part, even though he never knew his part. Though his great gift, we'll sing with heart, sing with passion, sing with gusto. Feel the music touch your soul. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. You will join us for the last four verses. You don't have to stand. It'll be easier to see me conduct. But I'm really worse than he is because I don't even have the hint of skill, but I've got all the passion. So all creatures of our God and King, the fourth verse will be very quiet.
Gather round and let us sing.
That's it. Thanks, Ardeen, for a wonderful evening. We're supposed to honor you, but you honored us. Thank you.